old at this time. Welcome to the PPP podcast.
Welcome to episode 13 of the GTT podcast. I'm your host, Dan Lowry, and on today's show, we have the industry heavyweight, Luke Lehman. I'm going to give you an epic episode warning here. This was an awesome conversation. I really, really enjoyed this one. In fact, I think Luke and I spoke for about half hour before the recording even started here. Luke is a fitness professional of considerable attribute. He's the founder and head educator at MuscleNerds.net and the former head educator at the Poliquin Group. For anyone who knows the caliber of education there, you'll understand how significant it is to be the head educator there. Luke has an amazing, amazing knowledge for biology and exercise physiology, and I have no doubt that if you have even a passing interest in how the body works and physical fitness, you will find this episode to be one of the very best I've recorded so far. All right, enjoy the show, sit back, this is a good one, and I'd love to get a bit of feedback from you on the iTunes review. If you do enjoy it, please give me a five-star review. All right, Luke, welcome to the show. Mate, same question I ask everyone at the start of the show. Tell us how you got into training yourself.
How did I get into training, man? I've been training a long time. I think, you know, going back to when I was a kid, you know, everybody trains for Texas football. So I'm originally from Texas. And so it was inevitable that I would get into weightlifting. But I got a bit of a head start because of Arnold Schwarzenegger. And I think a lot of trainers, you know, they get into it because of that type of thing too. But I remember it was in the early 80s and Conan the Barbarian had come out. And I looked at Arnold and I went, that is what a man should look like. And then I looked at my father, who is a very short Jewish guy, and I'm looking at him going, oh man, I don't know how this is going to work out. But then my mother's side of the family is all Austrian and German. So I'm actually the shortest guy on my mom's side and the tallest guy on my father's side. And I went, well, maybe if I lift weights, I get the best of both worlds. I get the height and then I'll get the stockiness of my dad's side of the family. And I did. So I started when I was about 8 years old, just out of, you know, old Weider books and stuff I could find at the library where I lived. And then, yeah, just rolled onto it, got into junior high and started really hammering it with the coaches, and then high school, and started a powerlifting team when I was 14. Freshman year, I went to the head football coach and I said, hey, I've always wanted to wrestle. Can we start a wrestling team? And he looks at me and he goes, Luke, people don't wrestle in Texas except for like really big schools. And my school was way out in the country, like less than 7,000 people. And he goes, well, we can do powerlifting. And I was like, what's that? He goes, you just lift heavy ass weights. And I went, let's lift heavy ass weights. So we started a powerlifting team. We were pretty dominant all 4 years that I was in high school. And then when I went to college, I kind of got away from that because I got in with a bodybuilder crowd, started bodybuilding in college, left college, got out of that, went back into powerlifting, and then got fed up with all the equipment people wearing, like the bench shirts and the squat suits. And I didn't like it. It wasn't strength. It was more technical. And it was cheating at the time. And I respect the guys that can lift in the equipment, but I think like the raw powerlifting and that was more of my style. But so I left it for a long time and never competed again, but got back in the bodybuilding. So I've been kind of in and out, did some strongman stuff and that type of thing. And then lifting for over 30 years.
Mate, I think it's a fairly common point of inspiration, the Arnold Schwarzenegger line of inspiration, especially, you know, for people who are watching any movies in the late 80s, early 90s. It's kind of like this subliminal messaging when you're watching Commando and Predator and all that stuff. And it's kind of like, all right, that's how I'm meant to look. I think I was probably... I probably started a little bit later than you with lifting. I think I was doing push-ups and lifting light dumbbells from about the age of 12, and had a home gym at the age of 14. I think for my 16th birthday, my mum bought me a casual pass to one of the original gyms in our town. I just went there all day. So a lot of that was definitely fueled off watching those action movies.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%. And like for me, it was like the G.I. Joe cartoons, like the old school G.I. Joe cartoons where they're just jacked and like big cephalic vein and biceps. And you're like, yeah, that's a man. You know, I want to be that, you know.
Yeah, definitely. Well, the other influence, which wouldn't have been an influence in Texas, obviously, but growing up in Tasmania, we watched AFL football all the time. And, it's a sleeveless football code. So you'd really notice the players who had good definition in the arms.
Yeah.
It was like, right, that's what I want to look like when I play football. So, you know, it was push-ups and bicep curls all the time. But, mate, there's so much ground for learning through that whole process of getting into lifting. You talked about sort of being back and forth between powerlifting and bodybuilding. How did that shape your early career and the amount of time or where you spent your time early on in your own training career and how you train clients? Or how did it get you into training clients?
Yeah, so like in high school, I was lucky enough to have really good high school coaches. They were all ex-powerlifters. They were all ex-collegiate ball players. So I had a really very good instruction from the age of 14 to 18 on how to lift weights properly, which a lot of people in high school don't get because the coaches usually don't know what they're doing, you know, especially at a small school like we were at. In 1992, that's when we first got the internet. So I was, 14 years of age. And that's when I'd found Muscle Media. I'd found like then Testosterone Magazine online, TMAG, what's currently now TMAG. Then I found Charles Poliquin. And, you know, reading through Charles' stuff and Paul Check's stuff and Charles Staley's stuff and all the old school things, it really resonated with me. I'm like, okay, here I am. I'm in this tiny small town in Texas in the middle of nowhere with a bunch of cowboys. I don't have any really good resources for this. The internet really opened up my eyes to strength and conditioning and just a plethora of information. And so I just started learning, just studying everything I could. And then Charles resonated with me the most because I'd always been a power athlete and he was all about strength and power. So I would do programs that he put on TMAG and I would grow and I would keep growing. I'd get bigger and I'd just eat more and I'd get bigger and the shit worked. So I said, you know what? I need to meet that man at some point. Mm-hmm. And so in 2007, I had saved up enough money and I went and did my PICP1 and I did BioSig, which at that time was like a 1-day course, right? So I did that and then went to PICP2 and just fell in love with the culture of the old Poliquin Strength Institute. There was a massive culture back then, right? So like a real like brother and sisterhood, not like there is now. Like the Poliquin Group's nothing like it used to be. So even when I was a head instructor at Poliquin Group, they had kind of lost that mojo. But I just fell in love with it. Did PICP 1, 2, 3, couple of BioSigs, a lot of special interest courses like training SWAT team tactical members, CEOs, that type of stuff. And Charles came up to me at one point and said, hey, you look like you're pretty involved with this. You know, we've talked a few times. You sound like you know what you're doing and you know like what we're about. Do you want to come teach for us? And I was like, yes. So I started doing assistant teaching for BioSig. And then eventually in 2013, when he left the company, I took over his position as teaching BioSig and then as one of the lead instructors with Derek Woodsky. And then I did that for a couple of years and then eventually just left. Like being in that group and seeing some of the politics of how they act and some of the stuff that they were teaching, that when I opened a textbook, what they were teaching didn't really line up with what I was learning from like Dr. James LaValle and reading in biochemistry textbooks and things. And we started kind of going back and forth about how we needed to change things. And they were getting more and more upset with the way I was being vocal about teaching things that weren't in the curriculum. Like I would go and kind of go off and start teaching stuff. And so eventually we just parted ways. And I started Muscle Nerds with Zoe with cool. my wife. So basically.
Charles was such an enigmatic figure. I mean, I did the PICP 1 and 2, and I did a weightlifting course seminar that he ran out here in Australia with Dmitry Klokov. And I'll never forget the quality of the one-liners and the stories. And
yeah,
he just had that amazing aura. But in addition to those courses I did do with him, I also, I think I read every article he ever wrote and every book he ever wrote. And the guy was a true genius when it came to strength training. You know, what he didn't know was knowing. What were some of your experiences of working closely with him?
Like, you know, it was fun. Like being around Charles, if you were in good with him, he was like probably the most generous, giving guy I've ever met in my life. If you were in good with him, if you weren't, he had no time for you. And so that he could be very temperamental. So depending on your relationship with him at that moment, it could be really good or it could be like completely awful. And I, for a long time, I looked at him like a father figure. And, you know, some of the stuff that I learned from him about training, like it's stuff that more people need to know, but not that many of us are left that know that stuff anymore, right? Because it's been so watered down. I like what they're doing now with bringing a lot of the older school guys back to help with the strength sensei stuff, to kind of bring that stuff back out, because the shit works, man. Like his knowledge of physical culture history and his predisposition to just throwing things out there, if whether they had been scientifically validated or not, he didn't give a shit. Like he was into the research, but he also said, look, if it works, it works. And if it's working, then who gives a shit why it works? Or, you know, if somebody says it doesn't, it works, so just use it. And, you know, using his methods and alongside of blending some West Side stuff, fuck man. I mean, at one point I was, at my peak, I think I was squatting about 318 kilos and deadlifting about 333 and close to 500 pound bench press using Poliquin stuff and West Side barbell stuff. So,
yeah. And there's, you know, I think too often the wisdom of guys like Charles and other guys who have just been in the game is thrown out in favor of, you know, whatever the latest study is. And I thought that Charles exhibited a great level of courage in how he would just come out and say, right, this is such and such method. It's a method I've used for 30 years. And the amount of hate he'd get online from yeah. so-called educated people because they're arguing that it couldn't be the case. And like he used to have some tall stories at times that would probably push the bounds of fiction. But when it came to methods that worked, he had an amazing knowledge set that transcended so many of the strength sports. And yeah. You know, certainly my experience of learning his methods were that they worked, and they worked really, really well.
Yeah. One of the things that I learned though, you know, quickly after my PSP 1 and 2 is I had to put things in context with who I train, and yeah. It became a lot. I trained Gen Pop. Like I trained some athletes, but the majority of the people that kept my bills paid were Gen Pop. And I quickly realized like a lot of the stuff that I learned needed to be heavily modified because it just didn't work for like a 48-year-old mother of three that, you know, had a full-time job and that type of thing. So, and that it became very apparent to me when I was teaching the stuff too, that the majority of people coming through Poliquin Group didn't train athletes. They would train, they might have one or two athletes, but they had 30 or 40 people that were just average people, and they didn't realize how to alter the methods or whether a method was going to be good for somebody or not. I mean, I shudder to think of some of the stuff I did to people in my 20s when I was giving them like Milos Arcev giant sets to some soccer mom that drove a van to Gold's Gym, you know? So, so, you know,
you'll be all right. Just have an Epsom salts bath. You'll be all right tomorrow.
That's all right. Just I'll give you a number of a guy who can put a handicap rail in your bathroom so you can get off the crapper when you need to stand up, because, you know, because the methods were, or, you know, they're designed. A lot of the stuff he did was he took all the stuff over the last couple of centuries of weightlifting, and he said, okay, I'm gonna pull all this, doesn't work, and I'm gonna organize this so people can learn and teach people like 5x5 patient lifter, teach them GVT. He's teaching him all these systems. He was really good at taking other people's stuff and systemizing it in a way that made sense so that people would actually be able to periodize and program. And I think that's really important, especially, you know, we were talking earlier before we got on about training Gen Pop. You don't see any coaches. Well, you see very few coaches that actually periodize for Gen Pop. Periodizing, all it is putting a long-term plan together for somebody. It doesn't have to be reserved just for athletes. And I think if you're really doing things correctly, you should be able to periodize a long-term program for your next door neighbor, you know, because their needs are a little bit different than athletes, but the process of planning and switching phases and getting certain physical attributes correct, it's all the same thing. It's just on a different level. And that's what we teach at Muscle Nerds. When we teach our program design, we're saying, look, we need to find out where your client is right now and where they want to go. And we're taking a road trip together. So we need to know, like, first things first, we have to get the car roadworthy. So if you're running on 4 flat tires and the check engine lights come on and your wheels are out of alignment and you don't have a windshield, we need to take care of this stuff first before we get into more specific training. So if we think about it that way, we need a general physical preparedness phase before specific phase. Was that not how we train athletes? So why aren't we training Gen Pop in the same manner where we're running them through structural balance, getting them out of pain, getting them moving better mechanically, getting them more aerobically fit? And then Bob's your uncle, you can go to the specific stuff when, and they're going to actually get more out of it without worrying about getting them injured.
Yeah, and definitely. You know, some of the points of discern there, you touched on it when you talked about the programs that you learned through Charles, being great programs for athletes, but you know, sometimes needing adjustment for general pop. And I see in your education history too, you've done some stuff through the Czech Institute. And that was a line of education I did a lot of in my early days as a trainer. And a lot of it was very confusing because it was very sort of therapy focused. But over time, as my skill set developed, I learned a level of discerning around Paul Czech's content that made it so much more useful. And the sort of the combination of those two outlooks that those guys had, they hated each other in the end. But I understand at one point they used to collaborate and talk a lot. And I know that in Paul Czech's early stuff, he'd reference a lot of Charles Poliquin's work. But I think, you know, the real challenge is early in your career as a personal trainer, you're getting all this information and you're learning all this stuff about the methods, which you've got to pile on top of your understanding of principles. And the danger is that many Gen Pop clients get sacrificed at the altar of your learning and progress. But for me personally, definitely over the years, I got better at just looking at it and going, okay, I've got this client who wants this. I'm going to take a bit of that from Charles. I'm going to take a bit of this Swiss ball stuff here as maybe our accessory work instead of a triple set or a monster set or whatever it is. And you're starting to put those pieces of the puzzle together in a way that works really nicely.
That's the key, right? It's just like with everything, you've got to lay a base foundation of knowledge, and then you have to pick and choose the right tools for the job. And yeah, you're right. Especially as a younger trainer, when you first get into the industry, when you learn something, well, I just paid to learn that. I'm just going to give everybody this. And realistically, like that's one of the first things I tell our students when they do our education. We're not trying to reinvent the wheel here. Like, if you're already getting good results, you what you're doing is working, but let's see what we can layer on top of that to make it even better and make it safer and make it more effective. Don't train like we train. Just see what you can pull from that and how you adapt your own training to evolve into your own type of systems. And I think that's really important, because I did the same thing, man. I would find the latest, greatest program and put Mary Muffintop on it and just completely destroy her. And I couldn't figure out why I couldn't keep clients. Well, they didn't. Gen Pop clients don't want to be hobbling around every day, you know, because their legs are so sore. They've got so much DOMS that they can't even stand up or sit down on the toilet. That's not what they're looking for. Yeah. And Charles, you know, Charles was big about strength. Like, you just need to get stronger in everything. And, you know, Gen Pop, they don't really give a shit about that, right? Like, most guys that come into your facility, they want to look down and see their feet for the first time. And they want their wife to look at them like they did when they were 20. And women want to put on a one-piece bathing suit and not feel embarrassed. Like, that's the reality of Gen Pop training. I don't have anybody coming to us asking to deadlift 300 kilos. It just doesn't happen. Like, I do because of the demographic I train with coaches, but in this facility we're building now, like, I'm not expecting to have any monster powerlifters coming in wanting to do, you know, or weightlifters or things like that, wanting to come and do snatches and cleans and heavy deadlifts and things like that. I'm expecting a lot of broken, busted up, stressed out, you know, CEOs and business owners and that type of thing come in that, you know, need to get structural rebalance because they're sitting at a desk all day and typing on a computer all day. And, you know, they haven't taken a solid shit in a week. You know, that's the reality of when you're opening up a facility for the general population. That's their problems. Their problem isn't that they're too weak. Their problem is that they don't move well. And then
yeah, totally.
Yeah. Strength might be an issue there, but we have to get them moving better before we can put strength on top of that.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, as you know, it's something that'll just happen as a result of doing the reps. You don't necessarily need to be doing a 5-3-1 wave loading, in those early days. Just getting some 8-12 reps will cover those bases and they'll get stronger.
Yeah.
I don't know about you. I mean, I'm turning 40 this year, and I remember you saying you were 42, but I think with the hindsight of time and experience and just feeling, going through these phases myself, you know, going through learning strength training by going all in, but also feeling the downside of that, I've definitely become a different trainer and a different programmer from a point of empathy, and probably coming from an angle now of how can I help people feel better, and just sort of balance out those body comp objectives that we used to get through those harder trainings and that density style training with, okay, how do we use a bit of that but temper it with other stuff that's going to help people feel better?
Yeah, 100%. And that's the thing, like, people want to go to a gym and they want to get results, but they want to feel better, not worse. And what we see a lot is people that are broken, too broken to be doing even like a bilateral squat. Most people that I see, even coaches that come to us, they don't have an orthopedic profile that deserves to be able to bilateral squat right now. So we might take people through split squats for 6 to 8 months before I ever let them back squat, if I let them back squat at all. You know, one of the things that we'll tell people is, you know, why do you feel the need to back squat? I love the back squat, but it's not for everybody, and it's for certain times. And for me, you have to show me that you've earned it. You know, that's like one of those big technical lifts. It's a dangerous lift when you start getting really strong, and you have to get to the point where you can get into a deep position with no pain and move properly. And I want to see all the joints looking well and your knees tracking well. And if you can't display that, then we have to regress that until you're strong enough and mobile enough to get into that position.
Yeah. All the young trainers who love squatting and deadlifting heavy at the moment are probably listening to this thinking, you pussies. But yeah, you do get the benefit of, I mean, I don't know about you, but I've definitely as a professional been the beneficiary of learning these lessons the hard way myself. What are some of the evolutions you've gone through from being a power lifter lifting 300 kilos plus and some of these lifts to where you are now? What were some of those lessons for you that have allowed you to become a better trainer?
Yeah, I think one of the lessons now is to understand that when you're young, your body recovers from things a lot better, and you're less prone to accidents and injuries. And if you do get hurt, you pop back a lot faster. But it's almost like a credit card. Like, I'm going to, like, all the stuff I did when I was powerlifting, I never got hurt in powerlifting. It was when I stopped powerlifting, and it was later on that now I'm starting to pay for it. And what I realized later on, learning more about anatomy and physiology, and learning that, you know, there's a lot of stuff I did back then to get strong that was probably way out of balance with how the body's supposed to work. And now I'm finally at a point where it's starting to manifest itself. And now I have to regress back, and I have to take care of that stuff that I should have been taking care of back then. One of the biggest things is the conditioning work. You know, I was always told we don't need an aerobic base and blah, 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 and all this. And, you know, that, you know, pussies run and that type of thing. And so it was just about smashing heavy weights. And then, you know, you wake up one day and your blood pressure is 150 over 95 and your resting heart rate's 95 and you can't figure out why you feel like shit. And you can't even walk a flight of steps without needing a post-workout shake. Like, that stuff catches up to you. And when I was still competitive powerlifting, I couldn't walk up 3 flights of stairs without needing a nap. You know, that's how, because we didn't do conditioning back then. That was before the Prowler had been invented. Like, we just lifted weights. We thought the video was going to make weaker and that type of thing. And that's one of the things I wish I could go back and tell myself is take care of your conditioning and take care of your sleep and stop focusing so much on the lifting and, you know, some of the other things that come with powerlifting on a competitive level, which is, you know, watch the gear use, you know, watch the sodium, take care of your heart, take care of your vascular system, you know, take care of that type of stuff, because you might be able to get, you know, by in your 20s by not taking care of that stuff, but your mid 30s, that stuff starts to catch up to you. And I was warned by all the older lifters, like, wait till you're 35. Once you hit past 35, things change. And I went, nah, I know what I'm doing. I'm doing everything right. I woke up on my 35th birthday. I stepped out of bed and I looked at my hip and I went, what the fuck is that? Something's wrong with my hip and in my neck. And I was like, they're right. Like it's like a ticking time bomb. And a lot of the younger trainers, they need to look at those older trainers and understand that they've been there and done that. And they should probably listen a little bit more, even though they don't want to do it, it's probably important that they take care of it now so they don't have to pay off that interest later.
Yeah, it's definitely a thing. I definitely noticed the same effect as I've gone deeper into my 30s. And just that tolerance, the main thing I've noticed is my tolerance for any kind of intensity or volume. And so, especially with lower body lifts or the full body lifts, squats and deadlifts, I can still do them and I can still do them, you know, well enough. But, I think my best squat ever is like 240, and I could probably squat 200 kilos now, but what it takes to be at 240 or even 230 for me, just the toll that takes versus being able to do 200 cold without really doing much squatting, it's just not worth it. But I was definitely one of those trainers who used to hear a conversation like this and just think, But with the benefit of age, I've become a little bit more wise to that as a concept. And every experienced lifter, you hear them say the same thing. They're all, if I think there was a really good book through Dragon Door. I used to buy a few of the books off there, and there was one where they went and interviewed all these old meatheads, and they said, if there was one thing you could have done differently, what would it have been? And just about all of them talk about wishing they had have done yoga or done more cardio or had a more balanced approach to their physical culture or you know, their physical exercise.
So, you know, you've got, if you look at, training as a matrix and you look at life as a matrix, and you've got all these different qualities. So you've got conditioning qualities, and those can be broken down into certain qualities on a continuum. Like everything's on a continuum from aerobic to alactic. You look at strength as on a continuum from strength endurance all the way to super maximal lifting. You look at the lifestyle stuff of getting enough sleep, nutrition, that's the continuum, deficit to a surplus, what type of magazines, all this stuff you have to manage. If you are in a sport that dictates extremes like powerlifting, well, you're going to be obsessing about strength, and you're going to be doing is max strength. Built the balance of this stuff off a little bit, and you have to understand that at some point, that taking away from those other qualities, you're going to have to pay for that later. You're going to have to take care of it later. And I've seen that all of my buddies who are competitive powerlifters, they're now starting to get the idea that I should probably get on an exercise bike and do some conditioning because my blood pressure is way too high, and I sleep like shit. I've got sleep apnea, and they've got all this stuff going on. So, you know, sometimes sport dictates that you do have to go to extreme. But then what people end up doing is they go all in on one quality at the sacrifice of all the other qualities when you don't really need to do that. And it's actually detrimental to do that. You know, if you're going, you know, powerlifting dictates that you need to be tight. It's a game of leverage. It's a game of leverage and tightness and things like that. But that's the whole goal of a powerlifting meet. So what people should be doing when they're powerlifting is trying to keep their conditioning in their general physical preparedness phase, and then don't worry about the conditioning when they're prepping for a meet. But they've got to keep some of the stuff in balance, because if they don't, it's always a recipe for disaster with some type of muscle tear or a joint issue, you know, and it happens to everybody.
What are some of the favorite conditioning methods or recommendations you'd make there? Because there are, I mean, I've seen a huge growth in recreational powerlifting the last 3 years or so, and I think it's great in that it's getting people who otherwise might not have gone to the gym or maybe just went to the gym and fluffed around. It's giving them a bit more structure and focus and something to compete in. What are some of the recommended Loop Lehman approved conditioning methods you've recommended those guys?
Well, the first thing is you've got to take basically a needs analysis of what's going on. So, you know, a lot of powerlifters will poo-poo away from aerobic training because, you know, it's boring. You know, that's one thing. But they think it's going to be detrimental to their maximal strength. But, you know, there's a plethora of different types of conditioning methods you can use. It depends on where you are on that spectrum of is this going to be detrimental to powerlifting or not? If you're doing a lot of really hard conditioning, that's probably going to be detrimental. If you're doing low-level aerobics, that's going to build a good cardiovascular engine, that's not stuff you really have to recover much from, and there's a lot of health benefit. But you know, you have to also layer in nutrition and things like that. So if I have a powerlifter coming to me and they're like, look, you know, here's where I'm at, and I take their blood pressure, and I've seen guys with 210 over 100 blood pressure, right, with resting heart rates over 100, and they're not sleeping well, they got night sweats, you know, they've got sleep apnea, they've got all these issues, the first thing I'm going to do is tell them to do aerobic training, and I'm going to tell them to do the boring shit. Like, I want you on a treadmill. I want you at 130, 140 beats per minute for even 60 to 90 minutes every day. And they look at me like, they're like, are you fucking stupid? Like, I'm going to lose all my gains. Like, no, we're not, because we're going to replace those calories that you're burning with more calories from food. Because all I'm caring about is building that aerobic engine and building a better, more pliable cardiovascular system and a better functioning heart. I don't care about using that for a deficit. So if you're doing 90 minutes of walking on an incline and that's helping your cardiovascular system and your blood pressure and your heart rate, I'm going to replace that with food, so you don't have to worry about that being taxing on your lifting. And it's actually probably going to make you a better lifter anyways, because it's going to give you a better work capacity.
Mm. You know, Great advice.
So build that foundation. And once you build that aerobic foundation and all your health metrics look good, you don't really need a whole lot to keep it in check, unless they start going back the other way. And inevitably, you know, going into a powerlifting meet, a lot of those metrics are going to get skewed anyways. Going into, say, like the last 3 or 4 weeks, a lot of our powerlifters, we will overtrain them. Like, we'll do it on purpose. We'll overreach them. We'll give them a good 10 or 12 days of a deload going into it, because we are actually trying to stress them out so their body's more tight. But I don't want them to be overly tight when they're in their early stages of prep, because then that's where muscle tears happen. That's where joint injuries happen. You know, and if you get injured, you're not going to be a great powerlifter anyways. You're constantly hurting, if you're constantly in pain. So what we try to do is get people healthy, and then we try to maintain health until it's time to get unhealthy. And competition isn't healthy. It doesn't matter what competition you do. By default, it's going to be something extreme. It doesn't matter if you're powerlifter, bodybuilder, you're strongman. It doesn't matter if it's competition chess. I don't give a shit what it is. There's no sporting endeavor you're going to do that's inherently healthy, because it's all out of balance with what your body's supposed to be doing. So trying to maintain that health as long as we can, and then spending a small amount of time being super unhealthy right before the competition, and healthy again after the competition. And we've seen that to be probably the best route to it. A lot of the guys tend to do a powerlifting meet, and they're completely wrecked, and they just jump right back into powerlifting training again. And a lot of them compete too often, you know. Mm. Same thing with bodybuilding. You'll see people they'll do 6 bodybuilding shows a year. It's like, you're always dieting. Like, when are you supposed to grow? When's your off season? Or what's an off season? My off season is when I binge because I can't manage my hunger hormones anymore. You know, and it's ridiculous.
Yeah, I get the impression. I mean, I think you touched on a really good point there with competition being an inherently unhealthy thing. And you're right. I mean, CrossFit, powerlifting, strongman—it's the same as playing football. You know, you're gonna get crunched. It's just slightly different. It's the object you've got to overcome, or the work volume you've got to overcome in a given time, rather than the opposition tackling you. But you know, then the whole bodybuilding side—that's a whole nother kettle of fish, isn't it? There seems to be I think to a large degree, a mindset of focused eating disorder that's going into that sport, where people are using it as a way of corralling that eating disorder, or those issues they have with food, so that they can have some sort of order around that, and using competition as a vehicle for sort of managing it.
Yeah. And people hate when I talk about this. So if you're a competitive bodybuilder, you listen to this, you're going to hate me saying this, but most people in the bodybuilding and even powerlifting have mommy daddy issues. They've got unresolved early childhood traumas. A lot of the girls come from an anorexic, bulimic background, and they've learned how to channel a really, really unhealthy thing into a less unhealthy thing by competing, because they're looking for something to give them a bit of, you know, feeling of control, you know, from a period where they probably didn't have any control. Same thing with powerlifting. You know, one thing I didn't talk about earlier is one of the reasons why I got into powerlifting and started trying to get really big and really strong is because I was bullied when I was a kid. And I figured, well, if I get really big and really strong, nobody will mess with me. And then I got to college and I realized that drunk people really love to mess with the biggest dude in the room. And then the biggest dude in the room, it's never a good idea when you smack somebody down because they're drunk, because then you're the bad guy. So I quickly realized that it didn't really matter how big and strong I was. If people are going to be assholes, they're just going to be assholes. And so I needed to go get therapy for my trauma shit. And that was very helpful.
It's some of the dichotomies of life there, aren't they? I mean, I think just about every guy who stepped foot in a gym has come from that place. Like, I know there's this big thing now about eradicating bullying. I think back to growing up, bullying, you got bullied and you bullied. And I mean, yeah. I definitely look back at some of the things that I did as a kid and I feel remorse. You know, I definitely bullied other kids. I got bullied as well. And it was like this... It was like this circular thing that went on, and I have no doubt that a part of my getting into lifting was to build that armor, build that emotional armor. And you think if you can put some muscle on that you're going to be more immune to it. I reckon that's a lot of guys who step foot in the gym.
Yeah, 100%. And it's just with the bullying stuff, it's a never ending cycle. You know, there's going to be the big kid who gets beat on by his dad is going to beat up somebody at school. That kid is going to look for the next weakest link to beat on. And then you're somewhere in that chain. So you're going to find somebody else that's weaker than you and you're going to bully them. Mm. And it's just, to me, it's just a part of being human, man. And I don't really talk about this on podcasts a lot because this causes a lot of debate. You know, my opinion, my philosophy is that humans are inherently opportunistic and evil, and we have to learn to be the best version of a good person. So, you know, you become an adult and you finally, maybe you get your shit together, you don't, but then you realize like, man, I was a real asshole at this age and this age. And you feel remorse, but you can't go back in time and change that stuff. You know, the stuff that you did in the past is what formed how you've focused on yourself in the present and how you go in the future. And if anybody virtue signals, and there's a lot of virtue signaling and, you know, social justice warrior type shit going on. And everybody tries to act like they don't have a glass house. And so they like to throw stones at everybody else's glass house because they don't want to realize that at some point they were a twat themselves, and I that just drives me crazy that, you get all this white knight bullshit and like, okay, you've never been an asshole in your life.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the more you learn about it, the more you can understand and start to forgive some of your own indiscretions on that. I mean, when you look at the root of what humans are, we're essentially wired for survival, for detecting dangerous people, for gathering resources, for getting what we need. And so you're obviously not overly aware as a kid. Well, you're not aware of any of that stuff. And so, you know, like you said, you're part of that cycle, you're part of the chain, and really you're just acting out on a loop. It's like an episode of Westworld, really, where you're not overly sentinel or aware enough to be able to intervene. I mean, I'm no psychologist, but I think some kids are just inherently less confrontational than others, so they don't get into that cycle. But I think if you grow up, if you've got a natural sense of competitiveness, you can really get drawn into that whole cycle and become a part of it. Cause what's the saying? Hurt people hurt people. And so you talk about that big kid who maybe got picked on by dad, and then they pick on the next person in the chain, and so it goes, and you end up with this whole population of hurt people who are going on to hurt other people. But I think if you learn, that's the aim of it all.
I think it's people live in a very comfortable time of period of time, and they don't realize, like, you look back 100 years ago at how you would have been living. Like, it's a completely artificial environment that humans are in right now, and an artificial social structure that we put ourselves in because of comfort. That's great because we have to evolve, but we have to also remember what we evolved from, which is, we weren't always apex predators. Like, we had to evolve into apex predators. If you look at every other animal in the animal kingdom, we don't have claws or teeth that they can hurt anything. We're not fast. You know, we really work best in groups. Like, that's hunter-gatherer lifestyle. And, people have to realize that humans are not, you know, they're opportunistic. They're basically, they're not really predators. They come along after something's already gotten taken. So, you know, if a human doesn't remain cognizant of that inherent human nature, then they don't really have a basis on what good versus evil is, which is what we're supposed to learn when we're a kid. And if you've been beat on as a kid, then your concept is that, you know, you're supposed to beat on other people. And then you learn later that that's wrong.
Mate, you bring up something really, really good there. So I can't remember where I read about this, but I was reading about the whole psychology behind bullying and also gossiping. So boys tend to bully each other. And what I read is that men, or boys and men, have, you know, for the entirety of our evolution, we've had to be able to trust each other, and we've had to be able to bank on the resilience and the reliability of the other men in the tribe. And so bullying had an evolutionary place in that it was a way of testing those guys that you had to be able to rely upon. And so there's a very base level part of our program, which sort of by default does that, just to test and just to see if you're a safe guy, if you're strong enough to withhandle me, I know that I can trust you when that great other from the other tribe tries to infringe upon our domain. And the same thing happens with women. Women don't tend to bully, but they tend to gossip about the other women in the tribe. And that's part of working out who's safe, who's pulling their weight, and who belongs.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. I mean, if we just go back to, you know, if you read Dr. Robert Sapowski's stuff about when he was, you know, studying baboons in Africa, you know, he talks a lot about it. It's the same social hierarchy in a baboon troop than it is in humans. And there's always somebody at the top, and there's always somebody trying to get to the top. And there's all this intra-fighting and gossiping and things between these animals. We do the same thing. We just do it on a more sophisticated level. But it's evolution. It's what we've come from. And, you know, I don't think we need to fight that. We just need to be cognizant that it's there. Like, anybody has the ability to do something truly heinous to another human if they're pushed to that point. And like, my wife really loves, like, she reads some wacky shit with like true crime stuff and like sociopath, you know, psychopath type of shit. And you see it in that, like, that cycle of abuse. And then that person, that their reality is that this is the police, and they can, well, because that's all they know. So if that's all you know, who's to say that's wrong? Like, society views that as wrong, but to that person, they're right, and because they've never been taught any different, you know. And I think, as being humans, it's important for us to always remember that if you let yourself slip mentally, you're going to take advantage of somebody. Unless you keep hold of that idea that you're capable of doing something truly heinous, you don't want to do anything heinous to people. And that's what, to me, brings up good morals versus bad morals. You know, some people need religion. Some people need religion, or they need something else. Like, but realistically, you've got to find that within yourself to be a good person.
Yeah. Yeah. It's fascinating. I like to just use the filter of in any situation, I just say to myself, is this a win-win?
Yeah.
Does this benefit both people? And if not, it deserves further thought and further consideration before you move.
Yeah. It's especially important in business, you know, especially like brick and mortar, where you've got somebody, people bringing you quotes for different things. Are they trying to take advantage of me? Like, and you always have that thing in the back of your mind, like, okay, I don't want to take advantage of this person, but I also don't want to get taken advantage of. And then it brings up all this angst inside where you're like, okay, let's negotiate something fair that's going to be equal for both of us. And, you know, it sucks, man. Business sucks.
Yeah. Well, the beauty of business is that you will not endure if you're predatory. And I read an article once about the nature of capitalism, and it was a really good article. It was quite enlightening. It talked about how there's this misconstrued belief that capitalism is a system of self-interest. But the article really argued a strong case for capitalism being a system of reciprocity, and how the businesses that endure and build the most goodwill are the ones that are based on reciprocity. And that doesn't mean you can't charge high prices or you can't have a premium product. But if you know, if you can create an exchange of value that's based on that, and you can help people get what they want, that's a far more enduring system than one just based off self-interest. So it's, yeah, it's a good framework. I think business, if you're a student of business, it'll definitely help you develop as a person. Becoming or going deeper into business, you know, from being a trainer on the floor to running a seven-figure business, it's forced me to learn skills that I just never had, and it's forced me to go through developmental stages I wouldn't have otherwise been a beneficiary of.
Yeah.
And it's forced me to find ways of finding value for other people that really do shine the light on this whole fact that you won't have the success that you crave before you're in business that you want unless you get really good at finding value for people. And it doesn't mean every exchange of value is perfect. It doesn't mean that every exchange of value works out for either party, but it just means more often than not, you're creating win-win scenarios.
Yeah. And that's the way to build it, right? If you create win-win scenarios, then more people want to work with you and they're more likely to be fair with you. If you're the type of person that's always taking advantage of people, which is common in our industry, you see it all the time. Like, you've got people that are killing it and they don't have any problem backstabbing and lying and stealing other people's material and doing all this stuff, but they eventually get found out. So a lot of them get a lot of early success based on the back of other people's work. But then later on, they get found out. Whether, you know, from my viewpoint, is I'd rather work for it over a long time and not take advantage of people and be fair and give credit and, you know, that type of thing. Build it more slowly. So there's a much delayed gratification when you're doing things the right way.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's you know, we walk a fine line sometimes between modeling and imitating. And I think I think it's just making sure you stay on the right side of that. I mean, I've definitely modeled people really closely at times, but yeah, you're going to have to find good value exchange. You're going to have to model, but not rip off. And just ask yourself, is this a win-win? Now, we've gone off on a nice tangent there, which I think it ties into some of the stuff that you're really good at. And we've skimmed around the general pop stuff, but we've gone into a bit of an evolutionary tangent. And it reminded me of a book I read once, The Story of the Human Body. And there was a quote in that. And the quote was, biology doesn't have a plan, but it has a great memory. And it was talking in regards to what it is that a human needs to be healthy. And I think one of the disconnects we can fall into in the fitness world is looking at what elicits the biggest changes in how the body looks versus looking at what our biology rewards us for and what biological stimulus we can provide that fosters best health. You start with that point of blood pressure. You talk a lot about blood pressure, and I've seen some of your other content where you talk about that. Why do you see that as the great tool of working out where people are at and what direction they need to go in? And how do you think all that ties into the anthropological model of human health?
I mean, what we look for is we look for things that are easy to do. Like, I don't need to send someone to a doctor to take blood pressure. I don't need to send someone to a doctor to take a resting heart rate or even an HRV, or there's, you know, a lot of other things we can do in the gym where it gets repeatable, it's cheap, and it gives you a really good gauge at where your client is on the health spectrum. And blood pressure tends to be one of those. When you look into the research, and it's constantly evolving, you know, most of the research that we use is about 20 years old, and it hasn't yet been, it's not actually being used by doctors yet. And what it's showing is that what doctors consider to be high blood pressure is actually really super high, and we need to bring the brackets down. In the States, it's changed. I don't know about Australia yet, but I know, like, I think in 2017, 2018, the brackets for pre-hypertension and then stage one, stage two hypertension were dropped about 10 beats. And that was based off of some material that came out in the early 2010s. I think it was a couple of papers came out in 2012 that showed, or no, I'm sorry, it was 2002, that showed that the optimal heart rate was somewhere around 115 over 75. Like, you use that kind of as a gold standard. And then we find some ranges where you want to keep your blood pressure under 120 over 80. And if it goes above that, then that's easy to take care of with, do some extra conditioning work. Let's do a nutritional assessment. Are you eating enough potassium for the sodium you're eating? Are you managing your stress well? Are you sleeping well? There's all these other things. Are you training with too much neurological work? Because that can make you overly stressed out, which can raise blood pressure. And everything.
And so when we're talking about neurological, just for the lay listener there, we're talking about heavy lifting, aren't we?
Yeah, a lot of heavy lifting. A lot of, if you look at like just a lot of high force lifting, you're putting a heavy load on your back and you're creating a huge Vasalva maneuver. You're creating a lot of internal pressure. And that can take its toll on vascular tissues and make things less pliable. And then if we look at it from an evolutionary standpoint, I know that a lot of lifters that love to lift, they think that lifting is you should be lifting by default. But realistically, evolutionary, we're not built for that. Like, when you go into archaeological sites, you don't go into a pyramid and find a weight set. There's no Nautilus weight sets that's been found in some pharaoh's tomb at any point. We're built to move, not to really load it heavy and move, right? So a lot of guys, we were talking earlier about the squats, right? Like, guys love the heavy squat. And if you think about why we need this squat, the body wasn't designed to put 400 kilos on your back and squat down. The body, the deep squat is made as a resting posture, or so you can take a poop without crapping on your feet, you know? So,
that's not good.
No, it's not good. So like, once you start loading a bar on the back and going into a deep squat, you're asking the body to do something it's not inherently designed to do. And there's nothing wrong with that, but you also have to keep in context there could be some consequences of that, especially if you're lifting too heavy too much. It's going to take a toll on your joints. It's going to take a toll on your sympathetic drive. If you become overly sympathetic, your brain, when you squat, doesn't realize that you're squatting because you want bigger, stronger legs. It thinks you're wrestling an animal. So it's going to respond by going into a state of fear and being threatened and being stressed, which is going to cause things like overproduction of adrenaline, which is going to cause vasoconstriction I won't say vasoconstriction because it depends where in the body, but we see where the more pressure you put in the vascular system, the more likely the vascular system starts to get unpliable, so it can't vasodilate when you're at rest. And so when that happens, that creates too much pressure, your blood pressure goes up, you start getting a lot of endothelial damage in the vascular lining, and then they start plaquing, and then eventually stroke or anything bad happens. And that happens in the brain, that happens in the cardiovascular tissue of the peripheral system. So people need to realize that stuff needs to be balanced out. And everything goes back to what is your brain's response to this on an evolutionary scale. And you're going to see this in the next 5 or 10 years. Everyone's going to be talking a lot about the brain. Physios will be talking about the brain and that's response. At Muscle Nerds, we talk a lot about nutrition in regards to what's the state of your brain. If your brain is in a state of fear and threat and stress all the time, you're going to lose metabolic flexibility because your body is going to prefer to use fast-acting macronutrients, which is carbohydrates. Well, if you're constantly overusing carbohydrate, if your liver's overproducing carbohydrates, if you're binging on carbohydrates because that's what your body's wanting to use as fuel, you're eventually going to overwhelm your cell with glucose, which is going to make the cell shut down. Now you're insulin resistant. Okay? So if you talk to most bodybuilders, they go, that's okay, just take a glucose disposal agent. So, okay, so I'm basically telling my cell, I'm going to make you take this glucose whether you want it or not. It's a good Band-Aid, but it's not a good long-term fix. Right? So we have to respect what the brain is feeling when we're doing things. If you're lifting really heavy, that's going to put your brain in a state of fear. That's going to eventually, if you wash, rinse, and repeat that often enough, that's going to cause some type of maladaptation in the cardiovascular system and also in the nervous system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the message is not don't lift, but it's let's do a bit of lifting, but let's do all the other stuff we got to do as well for best outcomes.
Yeah. And the best outcomes aren't going to be from training heavy all the time. The best outcomes are going to be from training a lot of different strength qualities and periodizing those in a manner that makes sense. And, speaking about general population, we never program Gen Pop for under six reps, because I don't really see, if I have somebody that comes into the Institute of Physical Culture, Karen's not asking me, you know, for a 200 kilo back squat. Like, that's not what she wants. She wants to feel better, poop better, think better, sleep better, wants a better relationship with her husband, with her kids, that she wants to be less fatigued. Her, where does maximal strength fit into that? It doesn't. You know what does fit into that? Training type 1 and type 2A fibers. So most Gen Pop people are going to be best off just sticking with general bodybuilding and strength endurance work, a lot of unilateral work and more stretch lengthening movements and things like that from sitting at a desk all day.
Cool. So if we start to go down the avenue now of examining what an ideal kind, you know, just generalized training week looks like for our Gen Pop client who's got family demands, work demands, and not much of an athletic background, let's sort of use the average. Most people tend to find, time for four training sessions a week. I find that's a pretty regular thing. We've got a very popular team training program at our gym. There's 6 days of training available, but most people average four. Where are you going to allocate your time or prioritize your time with that Gen Pop client who's got those four training exposures? What are we going to do?
So now we're also going off the concept that they're not going to do anything else, right? Like, they're not going to do any homework. They're only going to work out while they're at the gym. Then what we'll typically
do. Because we know no one does the homework.
Nah, they don't. So what I'm typically going to do is some type of concurrent system where they come in and they, depending on where they are, if they have high blood pressure, they're going to lift, but they're only going to spend 15 or 20 minutes with any type of lifting stuff. The majority of stuff they're going to be doing is, if they're lifting, it's going to be metabolic in nature. So they might be doing giant sets or tri-sets, real huffy puffy metabolic lifting. If they have really low blood pressure, it's the opposite. I might take somebody with really low blood pressure and have them do more functional hypertrophy, as long as they can do it safely, because that's going to bring the blood pressure back up and they'll do less conditioning. So it depends on where they are when they first come in. So for a lot of people, I like a concurrent program of kind of sectioning off an hour into two or three types of modalities. So when they first come in, it might be, you know, for the first 15 or 20 minutes, working up to some type of rep max, whether that's 12 reps, 15 reps, unilateral work, structural balance, you know, a repetition effort type stuff. And then once that's happened, then they might do some type of Metcon work for 15 or 20 minutes. And then it might finish off with 20 or 30 minutes of some type of aerobic work. And then I've got those three different levels. I can skew those any way I want to, right? So if they need more lifting, then they may lift for 40 minutes and then condition for 20. If they need more conditioning, they might lift for 20 minutes and then condition for 40 minutes. All right. Yeah. And it's not an ideal situation, but, you know, at an optimal position, but most people can't do that. So we have to do what's practical and what's going to give them the best bang for the buck and adapt their body in the manner that we want them to adapt in. And then those values will change over time. So let's say guy comes in, business owner, he's going to train 4 days a week. He's going to come in. He hasn't lifted in 20 years. And the first thing he's got to do is learn how to relift again, which means we're probably going to use a lot of stuff that's unilateral in nature, law of repetition of efforts. So it's going to be more muscular and strength endurance stuff initially, which we can get a lot of huffy puffy out of that too by minimizing rest periods. And then have them doing some type of aerobic Metcons. Maybe we do 2000 meter rows or something at the end of the workout or something like that. As he progresses on and he displays good technical knowledge and good technical feel of the lifts, then we work him through progressions until he's finally basically lifting the whole time and he doesn't really need the conditioning anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. Look, what I really like about that is it aligns with what I do. So it's always good to hear the confirmation from someone smarter than you. So tell me as all this is going on, what's the nutritional approach that you're tying this into? What are some of the basics there?
So here's my basic viewpoint of nutrition. If it's for performance, you're going to eat carbs. Okay. If it's for physique, you're going to eat lower carbs. And when I say lower carbs, that doesn't mean you're going keto. That doesn't mean you're going cyclical keto, targeted keto. It doesn't mean you're eating, you know, just veggies. It's different for everybody. But if you come in and you've got a lot of body fat to lose, you're not going to see carbs for a while. Okay? Because I've found it's a lot easier for them to manage their hunger. It's a lot easier for them to be more satiated if I feed them a lot of protein, and a lot of veggies and then a moderate amount of fat. And that tends to work. They immediately lose a lot of weight up front. That's very motivating for them. And we know a lot of that weight's going to be just glycogen and water and sodium. I don't care. If I've got a guy that walks in, he's 150 kilos and he's 57% body fat, I need to get weight off of him as fast as possible. I don't really care where it comes from, because the weight loss, his blood pressure is going to go down. He's going to sleep better. Eventually, when he starts losing enough weight, then we want to start bringing carbs back in. And I feel that you should feed somebody as many carbs as they can handle. Now, the thing is with Gen Pop is they just don't have a high enough activity level to deserve a lot of carbs. But if you want good brain function, your brain runs on carbs mainly, right? Your brain loves that. Your red blood cells run on that. Your balls run on carbohydrates, you know? So there's things that you need carbs for, but understanding too, that if you're overweight, your body's probably going to produce enough carbohydrates, enough glucose to funnel all that. What we need to do is teach your body how to burn fat more effectively at rest. Okay. So let's say we've taken this guy down. He's been training for whatever number of months, and now he's getting close to 20% body fat. Now I'm probably going to start bringing the carbs up a little bit more, and I'm going to start seeing how many carbs can we get away with before it becomes detrimental. And then as he gets closer to 12, we're really going to start ramping the carbs up. What I find is kind of from 15% to 12, if you stay on a lower carb diet, it tends to delay fat loss, or it's not as fast as it could be. And so once you start adding carbs in, now your performance goes up in the gym and you start training harder and your work capacity goes up. So from what I see, I kind of go off what Charles used to say, like, the fatter you are, the more you need to eat paleo, like the more you need to eat, and whatever paleo is for people, the more you need to eat like how you would eat if you were just a hunter gatherer. And the leaner you get, the more carbs you're going to need. And so that's kind of how we slide that scale on.
But yeah, that's one of the true genius pieces of advice that he used to just hand out all the time was earn your carbs. And, you know, paleo has been bashed over the years. And I think it's this whole mentality of splitting hairs, excuse the term, but the low hanging fruit for most people who are overweight, in my experience, is, all right, let's just clean up your diet. And you know, paleo gets bashed and the term clean eating gets bashed, but it's just a really simple framework for helping people get a lot of shit out that they're eating, to get them eating more vegetables, to get them eating good protein. And just as a byproduct of that, in my experience, 90% of people lose a lot of weight very quickly. And as long as you can have some sort of system, then once they get that initial result that helps them understand the context around that and the context of what they need to do next, it's just a really simple and effective method for getting people an initial good result that will keep them engaged.
Yeah. I mean, that's what we find. Like I'm very pro high protein, partially because I'm Texan and we eat a lot of protein, but because I see the best outcomes when people crank the protein up. Like if you can, like you deal with a guy, most guys don't have a problem jacking their protein up. If you're dealing with a woman, she's like, I don't know how I'm going to eat 120 grams of protein today. You're like, well, I suggest you use your mouth. So this is how we're going to do it. And I think that Gen Pop, because they know so little about nutrition, they don't understand, you know, how many calories are in things, how many grams of macros are in things. When you actually cook a piece of chicken and show them what 20 grams actually looks like, that's not a lot. That's like 75 grams weight. So when they actually see it, they go, oh, that's not that much. And I'm like, yeah, but that's all you're eating all day. So I need you to eat three times this and you're pretty sweet. And they're like, okay, got it. But everybody that we train, they're all starting out at different levels. We've got people that come in that know nothing about food and they're just nothing about exercise. And then we've got all the way up to elite level trainers who think they know about food and exercise, but they don't really. So we do a lot of tracking with our guys, not as even with maintenance calories. We'll just tell them to track just so they have a concept of how many calories, how much energy is actually in a piece of food. And then once they have that understanding of how much should be on their plate and they're hitting their calories, then we start removing the tracking slowly and we give them a longer leash. Right. And I shouldn't say this, but I look at it as training a dog, right? If you got a dog, you're going to keep a puppy on a real short leash. until that puppy can act right. And then you give the dog a little bit more leash. And if they keep acting right, eventually you can take the leash off and they just walk by you. Right. And so sometimes you have to use that with clients too, is you have to rein them in. Sometimes I have to give people meal plans, which I don't like doing. Once they've shown that they can be consistent, and they can manage hunger and they understand how food works, then we start using some flexible dieting. And then once they're successful with that for a while, then we move them more to intuitive eating. So that then they can manage their hunger. Right. But it's a learning process, just like going from a front foot elevated split squat to a back squat. There's a progression regression model for it.
Yeah. And developing those, not just the relationship around food, but the knowledge around or the wisdom around what's nourishing.
Yeah.
Versus
absolutely.
You know, versus just how much energy is in something.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So you've got to weigh that quality and quantity thing, right? So this is how much energy you need for the activity you're doing. And you want to get it from this quality food. So they both have to be talked about, right? And I find that the low carb approach works really well for a lot of people because it's damn near impossible to overeat calories if you're just eating protein and greens. It's almost impossible. But you're also going to find people who can't stay on that because they think it's boring. Some people don't know how to cook, or they start getting binges because they're stressed out. And then they binge and they get demotivated. They feel guilty. They feel stress. And so another concept we like to talk about with our clients is, like, there's no guilt around food. If you screw up, that's fine. Just get back on the horse. Like, I screw up all the time. And we say this is human, right? Your brain is going to compel you to try, especially if you're dieting and you're training, your brain is going to compel you to try to find foods with the highest amount of fast calories possible, which tends to be stuff really high in sugar and really high in fat and typically really high in sodium. So it's normal to fall off the wagon as long as you, and that's acceptable to fall off the wagon as long as you pick yourself up, dust yourself off, and just get right back on track as soon as you can.
It's a huge piece, isn't it? It ties back to that evolutionary model. When you're tired, when you're fatigued, you're looking for those hyperpalatable foods. Problem is, now we've obviously got access to hyperpalatable foods that aren't nutritious, and that's where that whole piece around teaching people the wisdom of nourishing foods is so important. What do you think? Where do you think sort of the supplement piece falls into this? I mean, I've got a lot of beliefs around. Educated beliefs around the need for most people to have a basic supplement protocol. How do you see that?
Yeah, absolutely. It's quite different than when I was teaching at Pollockin Group, because I now don't tell people to take 500 pills a day. But there is like a base level of stuff you need, you probably want to, especially if you're training. You know, number one, food isn't as good as it is ago. It's not going to be as nutritious if you're dieting.
Just repeat that again, Luke, because it just glitched out a bit. Just start again.
So with the supplements, we are pro supplement, but it has to make sense. So we've got, you know, base supplements that we use, like our base stuff, a good multivitamin, multimineral. And the reason is I've seen lots of labs over the last 20 years, lots of organic acids tests, lots of blood labs. We see B vitamin deficiencies, we see zinc deficiencies, magnesium. The food isn't the same quality as it was 100 years ago. And if you're training a lot, you need these cofactors to run your metabolism. You need to run the catabolism and anabolism part of that. And if you're missing something, it's going to slow things down. So I would rather somebody take some type of cheap insurance and a good high-powered multivitamin to make sure that we can rule out any type of deficiencies. Right. So like we use some pretty high power stuff from Thorne Research, just as a everything in the kitchen sink type of deal, so that you were assured that you're getting everything you need. And some of the things I see is like magnesium, zinc, B6, B9, B12. I see a lot of deficiencies there. A lot of people, vitamin A deficiencies because of SNPs in their genetics, like the BCL1 gene, where they can't actually change. They have a dampened ability to change beta carotene into usable vitamin A. So often we want them to supplement with that, especially if we see that they have subclinical hypothyroid issues or any type of autoimmune or immune type of issues, right? So a multivitamin, multimineral, we put almost everybody on that. We'll use fish oil if they don't eat a lot of seafood. Like, I'm not a big seafood guy, so I'll take 3 or 4 grams of fish oil a day just to round that out. creatine is another kind of non-negotiable. You know, there's so much data. There's decades and decades of data on creatine. You can get high quality creatine. It doesn't cost much. It's going to enhance your ability to perform. It's going to enhance your brain. It's going to enhance your sleep. There's a lot of things there that will, it's just a no brainer when you can buy 500 grams for $19. That'll last you damn near a year. You know?
Yeah. It's profound. Some of the stuff that's come out in recent times about creatine and its effect as nootropic as well. Right.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So that's kind of our base stuff. Maybe a little, the multivitamin that we recommend has almost 500 milligrams of magnesium and 30 milligrams of zinc, which is pretty good for most people. Sometimes if they're really stressed out and their sleep's an issue, we might give them a little bit of extra magnesium off the top of that, you know, and then above and beyond that, everything is by, I don't want to say prescription, but it's kind of like, I look at all of our clients and, you know, I say, okay, if you've got sleep issues, then we're going to look at some of those pathways with serotonin and melatonin production, which could be B6. It could be tryptophan shuttling off somewhere else. We might give them some 5-HTP with B6. We might give them some melatonin, which I know is illegal here, but you can still get it, which is ridiculous. You know, we might, you know, there's other things too. If we feel like they're, you know, maybe they're mentally fatigued, we might give them stuff to boost up dopamine a little bit. So we might give them some tyrosine and also B6 and stuff like that.
Yeah. I've got this double face palm moment. The first one is when I hear fitness professionals say, you don't need to take supplements. That's the first moment of the palm hitting my face and me thinking you're a moron. The second one is when, you know, you do your best to educate people on the importance of supplements and they kind of get it. And then they go to Chemist Warehouse and they buy the cheapest supplements they can. We stock Thorn Research as well at our gym, and the margin and the profitability on it for me is not nearly as much as if I used one of these cheaper brands. But the quality really matters. Tell us a little bit about the difference between a high quality supplement like Thorn or Bioceuticals versus the stuff you buy in the chemist.
There's a massive difference. There's a massive difference in where they're sourcing the stuff. There's a massive difference in the types of vitamins. When people see vitamin B6, they go, oh, this is B6 and that's good. But it depends if is it P5P or is it just basic B6? Is it, if I'm looking at B12, is it cobalamin or methylcobalamin or hydroxycobalamin? Is adenosyl cobalamin? There's a lot of different forms of these vitamins and some are better than others at certain things. So I see, you know, mineral blends with zinc oxide. Like zinc oxide is what you put on your nose so your nose doesn't burn in the Australian heat, right? The reason they put it on your nose is because it doesn't get absorbed. You know, if you look at magnesium oxide, that if you pull a multivitamin off the shelf or a magnesium product and all it is magnesium oxide, that'd be great to take a poop, but it's not going to absorb well. And that's kind of how it makes you poop. It doesn't absorb. So people need to understand that you either pay for a high quality supplement or you don't take anything at all, because the stuff you're getting at Woolies or Kohl's, and they do have a couple of good things there that I'll use, but most of the stuff is just garbage. And it's almost, you can look at it like as an anti-nutrient. It's probably causing more issues than it's fixing. So you want to stay with some good pharmaceutical brand like Thorn Research, who makes all of their stuff. Something like Bioceuticals, something like, what else is here? Meta Herbs. That's another good one that's in Australia. We've got, I mean, there's a ton of really good stuff. The only problem is it's sometimes hard to get. So it's great that you guys have it in the facility. What I tell our clients is you're not to take anything unless we either sell it to you or we tell you where to get it. And that, because trainers especially need to understand that supplements can be really good for people or they can be disastrous for people. Yeah. If you take the wrong form or too much of certain things, I've seen people take, I've looked at clients' sheets of all the supplements they're taking, and they're just taking massive amounts of folate, which they're like, well, it's a B vitamin, just pee it out. Well, if you're over methylating, this is why you're not sleeping. This is why you're agitated all the time. You've got too much folate. Like, you can take way too much of certain things. And when you start adding a bunch of different products together, and then you put that on a spreadsheet, you see that they're taking like 10 times the upper tolerable or the optimal tolerable limit of a vitamin, and you've got to pull some stuff back out.
Yeah, you've got to be careful you got to be careful with taking things in isolation, because so many of these vitamins, minerals, and trace minerals, they're cofactors, and so they're obviously going to do better with food, but do better in the presence of other compounds. That's why that basic nutrients or the multivitamin from Thorne's a good one. What are some of the costs? I mean, obviously magnesium is involved in a lot of different actions in the body, as is vitamin D, zinc, and everything else. But what are some of the costs to having that mentality of, no, I can just get everything I need from food, I'm not going to take supplements? What are some of the things that the consequences people might suffer, or some of the things they might miss out on?
Oh, absolute nutrient deficiencies. If you're training, you are chewing up these cofactors in order to make new energy and also replace muscle tissue, replace glycogen, to digest things, to break things down. You need these cofactors in all areas of your biochemistry. If you're training, you need to eat more. And what people normally do is they diet and they train more. And when that doesn't work, they just train more and they keep pulling food out. Well, you keep pulling these vitamins out, not replacing them back in. So in a lot of cases, people are massively undernourished from a point of not eating enough calories, especially when they're trying to lose weight, but also they're malnourished in a way they're not getting enough nutrients in. So if you're pulling food out, you probably want to take something that has all those cofactors in it as basic insurance. And when I talk about like how many calories we put people on, it blows people's minds because we diet people down. We've got girls that diet down on 3,000 calories. We've got guys that diet down. Shit. When I do contest or tournament prep for a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu match, I eat 5,000 or 6,000 calories a day because my output is so high. And that blows people's minds that you can eat that much food, but you have to when you're training 15 hours on the mat. And then you're also training four times in the weight room, or you're doing some extra conditioning work. Like, you're burning through a lot of energy. And, you know, trainers that don't know anything about food and they don't understand performance nutrition, they're training their clients with performance, but they're not giving them enough calories and enough certain macros in order to replenish the energy that they're burning off. So then we get maladaptations in the thyroid. We get issues with the adrenals. We get issues with stress. We get issues with sleep. We get issues with even losing fat effectively and building muscle effectively.
And I mean, if you've done this job for any period of time, you see that case time after time where it's like, okay, they're saying they're eating this many calories, they're saying they're doing this much training, but what I'm seeing here is a very different thing. And that's the true art form, isn't it? It's putting those numbers together, putting those scientific principles together, but then also understanding a lot of these concepts that to a degree are a little bit beyond the scope of scientific studies to definitively categorize as correct or not.
Yeah, and one of the problems with the scientific side of things is how are you going to do a study on a supplement? I mean, if you're doing a study on, say, a multivitamin blend, it's the only person who's going to study that is the people who make it. And then people say, well, it was funded by the people who made the blend. Yeah, because they're the only ones who would pay an obnoxious amount of money to show that vitamins work. So when you look at it, most of the studies you see are using single vitamins at a time, and then they're not using everything in concert like it should be, right? Yeah. So your doctor's going to tell you that you're just making expensive urine. Well, I'd rather have expensive urine than have cheap health. And we see it time and time again, especially, unfortunately, Thorne has discontinued Thorne Basic Detox because that's like the Ferrari of multivitamins, and they weren't selling enough to make it viable to keep it in the lineup. So now we're telling people to take Multi Elite, which is more of a performance based one. Anyways, it's also NSF certified. So if you're training athletes that are WADA, it's WADA approved and that type of thing. So it's safe for them to take. Doctors tend to forget about their biochemistry training and they just go into their pharmaceutical training and they say, well, you don't need to take all this stuff to get your blood pressure down. We could just give you something else for that. We'll give you an antihypertensive drug. Oh, by the way, that's going to screw up your cholesterol. So now I've got to give you a statin. Oh, by the way, that's going to deplete CoQ10. So here's a pharmaceutical CoQ10. By the way, you don't want to take that off the shelf fish oil. Here's a pharmaceutical fish oil. So they want to have all this control over this stuff where you know, if you didn't get on an antihypertensive, if you just did your conditioning, got some sleep, lost some weight, and then took a multivitamin, you probably could have kept yourself from being in the doctor in the first place.
Yeah. It's so obvious the perils of these reductionist views, isn't it? When you surmise it like that, you just got to take those blinkers off and look out and look at that ancestral model of what we're designed to do. You know, it's walking, it's running, it's eating with the tribe, it's eating certain foods, it's getting plenty of sun, you know, eating food that's been in the dirt, and you know, having access to foods that are nutrient dense but take a bit of work to break down rather than going straight into the bloodstream. The stuff I found really interesting to sort of dig deeper into lately has been all the type 3 diabetes stuff and the brain health, which you touched on a little bit earlier. And I, you know, the more I read about that, the more I see the perils of all this, if it fits your macro stuff, and less of a focus on the nourishing traditions of nutrition. And I see the price that's going to get paid later on that, similar to the price that 50 and 60 year old meatheads pay when they fall dead of a heart attack in those years. We're going to see similar things, but later on, and to do with brain health from people who've been a little bit too flexible in their dieting.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you've got to put this stuff somewhere, right? So if you are the way I look at it biochemically is everything's broken down into acetyl-CoA, and that's what drives your metabolism. So are we in a caloric toxicity? Are we pushing ourselves into caloric toxicity, or are we pushing ourselves into acetylcholine toxicity, right? Or acetyl-CoA toxicity. So your biochemistry is going to be dictated by hormones and by substrates. So if a substrate moves to a level of high, it has to be moved somewhere else. So if it can't go where it's supposed to go, then it has to be moved laterally, which can do things like create a metabolically inflexible person, which it can cause issues where sugar and fat can't get into the cell effectively, and then it hangs out in the bloodstream, and then it starts to glycate, so it gets really sticky, and it starts sticking to red blood cells, or it starts sticking to other things, starts plaquing in the brain. Your brain neurons use a lot of sugar. If you are in a massive caloric excess, or massive sugar excess, or massive energy or acetyl-CoA excess that's causing stress and causing a ramping up of that sugar, you're going to expect to start having some glycation in the brain.
So sugar does have some downsides, despite us being told maybe it doesn't.
Well, it does, but it seems that every macronutrient has a downside, except for protein. And protein can have some downsides. So obviously, if you've got low kidney function, then high protein diet's not for you. If you have issues with high urea, and you know, if your bun's off in your labs, you probably want to bring that a little bit over retinine, and issues there. Protein can have its issues too, but it's the least likely macro to have a negative effect, but it's the hardest one to get people to eat the most of. But you know, your body will make plenty of sugar from both fat and protein. So if you're starting a fat loss journey, you know, going with a lower carb diet and eating just a sufficient amount of carbohydrates, that's easy to get from lots of veggies, a little bit of fruit. You have a lot of success for that for a long time if you keep your calories at a sufficient level for both life and performance. And then later on, you can start bringing as you lose weight, as you get more metabolically flexible, your metabolism will inherently get better. And what we find is we can feed people more food as they get in better shape.
Yeah, it's pretty effortless fat loss, isn't it? It's the meat and veg, or eat like a vegan, but with meat.
Yeah, it's like you said earlier, it simplifies things too. Like if I want to make something simple, then I need to remove choices, right? And the simplest thing to do is drop something out. And the one macronutrient that dictates how the rest of your biochemistry runs is carbohydrates. So if I need to bring that down for a small period of time, and that allows you to start oxidizing more fat more effectively, then that's a win-win. But you know, you shouldn't be expected to live low carb for the rest of your life. And you know, if you have a lot of stored energy already on your body, that's a politically correct saying you're fat, then
political correctness free zone in here. Let's call it how it is.
So like, look, it, If you bring the carbs out, that's going to start raising enzymes to burn more fat. If you get more aerobically fit, that it's raising more enzymes. It's building more mitochondria. It's allowing you to produce and have better flux of energy through the mitochondria because you have more mitochondria working. So this is why we typically will front load people's training with a lot of aerobics initially to get their health markers better. But we're also building a lot more hypertrophy of type 1 fibers, some type 2A fibers, using bodybuilding and using some endurance work. That's going to build more mitochondria. That's actually going to make your metabolism go up. Okay. That's going to allow you to work harder and build your work capacity. You're going to start sleeping better. You're going to feel better. So you're going to have be more motivated to train. And then later, as we do more work, we put in more carbohydrates.
Yeah, absolutely. Two of my favorite things to do with training, you know, being 40 this year and having less of an appetite for really hard training, I've rekindled my love of running. I just love going for a 40, 50, 60 minute run. But one of the other things I really enjoy doing, and I got this off one of your social media posts, was the least mode session where, you know, I'll pick out 10 different machines in the gym. I'll go around and do a set of 15 on everything and just a full body workout. And then I'll follow it with a second round of 20 of everything just for getting that pump and really feeling good. So yeah, that's a good one. Now, whilst we're on the topic of subs here, obviously we're deep in COVID-19 lockdown at the moment. I've been reading a lot of stuff. It's only correlation-based science at this point. It hasn't been peer-reviewed, but a lot of stuff around vitamin D deficiency and mortality rates with COVID-19.
Yeah.
Have you seen any of that?
Yeah, I have. I've seen that and also vitamin A, because both of those nutrients are inherently important for immune system function. The thing is, too, in Australia, everyone is vitamin D deficient. Like the standards of what you should look at on a lab is really low. It's really far behind the times compared to America. So what an American doctor would consider really good vitamin D, an Australian doctor would consider toxic, and they'd freak out. Right. Every single lab that I see from an Australian is pathetically low, and also New Zealand as well, pathetically low in vitamin D. And it really doesn't take a whole lot to get you there. Right. And obviously, you know, supplements are supplements. We should be doing more to get, you know, the right foods in, but a lot of people don't eat the foods that have enough vitamin D and enough active vitamin A in it. So, you know, supplementation might be the best route for people, especially initially. If you want to get your vitamin D up really quickly, you're probably going to have to take a lot of it up front and then go take a lab panel and then bring it back down. The problem is that doctors in Australia most of them won't order a vitamin D panel because they already know everybody's so deficient, there's no point. But they also won't take vitamin D. So then take your health in your own hands sometimes. And, you know, one of the websites we'll tell people to go to is imedical.com.au. They can order a vitamin D panel and any other blood test they want, and they can pay for it with cash, walk into a clinic and get a full panel. I have a male and a female panel that I wrote up for our clients, and it's like $347. And it's basically everything you could ever get checked, that you'd want to get checked on, like a comprehensive metabolic profile and a few extras for, you know, testosterone, biological testosterone and estradiol and things like that. But I highly encourage people, if your doctor will not give you a vitamin D test, to just go pay the $40 and get it done and see where you're at. And if it's low, start taking a lot more vitamin D. And then after a few months, go back in and retest it and make sure you're staying in the right range. And then for sure, when the sun is at the right angle, like in the summertime and the spring, and depending on where you are on the continent, try to get out and get a lot of sun, right? Like you guys in Tassie, you guys don't have a lot of opportunity for vitamin D. Like I'm in Brizzy, so we get it almost year round. So it's important to get outside and try to get that vitamin D at the right times of the day and making sure that you're taking care of that. And we've got an app that we like to use called D-Minder, and it'll tell you what the UV index is. It'll track how much vitamin D you're getting depending on what the skin tone is and how much clothes you're wearing. And then you can hit a timer and it'll tell you when you need to get out of the sun so you don't get burned. So yeah. I think that's a genius app. And if you're taking supplements and you have a blood test, you can put all that data in there and it'll track it over time. And then I found it to be pretty spot on every time I've gotten the panel, that as long as I've tracked it in the app, then my bloods have been pretty set with what the app's showing.
Yeah. Some of the stats around vitamin D deficiency and all-cause mortality are just out of this world too. Once you start digging into that, you're like, holy shit. We've got a fairly consistent routine in our house of supplementing with vitamin D from Thorn, the DK2. We also take cod liver oil on a daily basis, and we eat pate. We eat chicken pate, duck pate. Oh, it's great. Love it. So we're getting that vitamin A and all those fat soluble vitamins too, which is part of that whole sort of nourishing nutrition focus and just some of the stuff we've forgotten over the years.
Yeah. And it's a lot of the foods, the traditional foods that people don't eat, especially if you're white, you typically don't eat weird foods. So you don't eat offal. So you don't eat liver and brain. And like, I grew up on some of that stuff, like scrambled eggs and brains and, you know, eating like sweetbreads, which is like a thymus or pancreas of a cow. And, you know, I was never a liver guy, because in America, most people that eat liver are in the northern parts of the United States and the Midwest. In Texas, we never really ate that. But eating more liver, the cod liver oil is a great source of vitamin D and also vitamin A.
Mm. Yeah, it's good stuff for sure. All right, Luke. So wrapping it up, let's do a quick little summary here. The sort of, you know, top 5 to 10 things our general pop in their 40s looking to get in better shape and feel better. Let's go through a bit of a revision. Things they need to do, things they need to avoid.
Okay. I think the number one thing is to understand that humans are designed for movement, and weightlifting isn't the only thing you could be doing. And if you are lifting weights, start considering, I've been really big the last few years on doing a lot more lengthened range of motion lifts and a lot more weighted mobility. So if you're doing a lot of squatting, definitely for an accessory supplementary work, finish that off with some split squats. If you're doing deadlifts, rack pulls and things, finish off with some RDLs or good mornings. Put your muscles in a lengthened state and try to strengthen them in the lengthened position, because what we've seen is the majority of people that are dysfunctional and screwed up, it's because they don't have good length tension across joints. So they're not moving enough. They're basically sitting at a desk in a cast all day. You know, if you've ever broken your ankle or broken your elbow and you've been in a cast, you take that cast off and you don't really have good range of motion. Like, everything's gotten tightened up. So I view sitting at a desk all day for 8 to 10 hours as the same thing as being in a cast, you know, if you're not getting up and moving around. So movement first, then strengthen the movement. And that'll go a long way of keeping you, keeping the maintenance for your joints and all your musculature, and making sure that you're not in pain and moving around, and have fun with your training. Like, people take their training too fucking serious. Like, they feel like training has to have a specific purpose. And with Gen Pop, to look better naked and feel better at the beach. I mean, that's realistically what most Gen Pop people want. They don't give a shit about maximal strength or speed, or, you know, they don't care. You're going to put a tendo unit on the bar and measure fucking meters per second. They don't care about that stuff. Nutrition wise, you know, we recommend everybody tracks for a small period of time, just not as dieting, just to get an understanding and concept of what food looks like and how much energy is in food. Making sure it's well-rounded, eat your veggies. Your mom was right, your grandmother's right, eat your veggies, right? Mm-hmm. And for me, like I said earlier, I'm a high protein guy. So most of our clients will eat 2 to 2.5 to 3 times their body weight in protein. So like for myself, I eat regularly like 300 to 400 grams of protein a day. But if you're not willing to eat your greens or eat your veggies in the same amount, then you don't deserve the meat. So if you're gonna eat 300 grams of meat a day, then, which is going to be, you know, 1.5 kilos or so, then you need to be eating 1.5 kilos of veggies with it as well. Okay. Mm. We like people to be prepared and meal prep, like learn how to cook, find foods that you can eat constantly over and over, because the less choice you have, typically the better outcome you have, until you get a hang on how to eat and how to prep intuitively, and then adding more stuff into your diet and kind of branching the variety out a little bit. It's 2020 and people still scared of fruit. Stop being scared of fruit. It's not going to give you fucking fatty liver. you know, do your conditioning, whether that's going for walks or, you know, like you said, getting in a good 45-minute run. I think a lot of people are finding out now with the COVID thing, they don't have a gym, they don't have a good concept of a lot of body weight training, but they know how to run. And I'm seeing a lot of people posting like, oh my God, it feels incredible to go out for a run. And if I went out and bought a DeLorean and got a flux capacitor and knew how to build a time machine like in Back to the Future, and I went back and told my 25-year-old self that you're going to love running an Animal Flow one day, I'd laugh at myself. There's no way. And now I love it because I love moving around. I like feeling better. I like being out of pain. So, you know, don't be afraid to go out and, you know, do couch to 5K, couch to 10K, get out there and pound the pavement a little bit. If you, you know, if your orthopedic profile dictates you can do it, if you can't, find a piece of cardio equipment you can, and you'll get you a good 20, 30 minutes of huffy puffy stuff a day. You know, get on an Aerodyne, get on a rower, find something you like to do, go play basketball. You know, and take that stuff seriously, because if you don't take care of it now, especially the younger guys, you're going to have to take care of it harder later. And you're going to have to go through some growing pains of realizing that what you and I are saying right now is the truth. We've been there and done that. We're both, you're almost in your 40s. I'm in my 40s. Take care of that shit early so you don't have to struggle later when you're in pain and it's hard to move. Take your supplements, take your multivitamin. If you're in Australia, especially South Australia, make sure you're taking your vitamin D, get some sunlight, go out, walk barefoot on the grass and all that hippie shit. You got to embrace the gym stuff, but you know, the hippies know a little bit about a little bit and they can get a little bit too much into the woo-woo side, but there's some truth to that of what you were saying, like eating vegetables, like don't rub your vegetables in dirt and then, you know, saute them and eat them. But you know, if you can get stuff from a farmer's market, if you can get stuff, and when I get stuff from Woolies and Coles and they tell you to wash off the potatoes, I don't wash them off. I just cook them with dirt and eat them. Because that's what we're designed to do. So,
yeah. So, preach. I mean, preach, man. Awesome advice. Awesome advice. Yeah. Look, you're a superstar of the industry and a unique genius in this area. And I've always enjoyed listening to you on other podcasts. So it's been good to have you on this one, Luke. For anyone who is listening in, I think this is our longest episode we've done so far, and we've covered some good ground. Where can people follow you if they're interested in finding out more about your content and your info?
Yeah, so we're at musclenerds.net. That's the Muscle Nerds side. Soon we'll have our gym facility. If you're in North Brisbane and you want a facility to train out of, it's instituteofphysicalperformance.com. instituteofphysicalculture.com. I didn't have enough coffee today, but that website's not up just yet. Instagram, we're musclenerds_health, and you can find us on Facebook at Muscle Nerds as well.
Awesome. All right, mate. Thanks so much for your time today. Great stuff. I think this is going to come out as a great episode indeed.
Cool. Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
No worries, mate.